Mitzvah Shin Nun Aleph 351. Shelo Namir Hakodshim. We should not replace. How do you say our scroll say it in English?
Designate a substitute.
Designate a substitute. Okay. We shall not designate a substitute, which we say in Hebrew with one short word. We need a whole long phrase in English to say the same concept. Sanctified animals. Shelo Namir Hakodshim Shnum Ashkelomar Behema. So you have an animal that you consecrated to the altar, as opposed to Berech Kabayis, that you actually consecrated it for use as a korban.
What does that mean, you consecrated? What did you do, actually?
You use words. Harezo Ola. You go point to an animal and you say, this is sanctified to be offered up as an Ola, or whatever animal you want.
So not the smicha, though.
The smicha is at the time that it's offered up as the korban in the Beis HaMikdash, but the consecration is before. It's simply with words. We have things in halacha that can be affected with just words as opposed to actions. Shelo yimirua achar kein bivehema acheres shelo tikarev hi be'atzma. Ela tikarev hi be'atzma. That if you switch it, then the first animal should still be worshipped. Should still be offered up. And this is what it says in the Torah. Lo yachali fenu velo yamir oso. You shall not switch it, and you shall not designate a substitute. Umikevan shehimirua. Once you say, this is going to be the substitute for this, kolomer shamrulo zo tachazo, o zo tumura zo, that this is instead of this, or this is a replacement for this. And anything that indicates the similar concept. Even though you're only using words and you're not doing any action whatsoever, you receive the penalty of lashes. Even if there is a little bit of mistake involved in your designation, you're still Chayei Malkus. So normally, in order to be Chayei Malkus, you need to have Hasra. You need to be warned for a specific action. And then you have to say, no, I'm going to do it anyway. Then do that specific action. But here, even if you make a little bit of a mistake, you're still Chayei of Malkus, yeah?
But what if, let's say, there are two animals that look absolutely identical, as most animals do.
To us.
Nor as laymen, Okay. So you say, okay, that one over there. And then you turn your back, and then they switch positions, and you don't know which one you pointed to. At that point,
that's a real problem. There,
the robe then, or
what?
The closet.
The closet.
Mm-hmm. Is that the answer?
In this case,
you stick them in the closet and you starve them to death.
Well, that's we discussed last week with that. But there is a way out of that in most times. So there is. First of all, if you just have two animals and you got mixed up, so you could consecrate the other one.
Oh, okay.
They're the same type of korban in many cases, and you just are makri both of them. Or there's also what's called pedia, where you can redeem the sanctity of the animal on an object. So either money or another animal. So that is permissible. So there's a difference between tamura and pedia, where you say pidyon is when you say the sanctity of that animal should be transferred onto this animal. You don't say it's a dachistic distinction. The tamura is when you say this animal should substitute for this animal, but if you say the kedusha of the first animal should be redeemed onto the second animal, so that would be okay. But there are
How does that work? I don't know.
You deconsecrate
that distinction.
There's not really a distinction except for the way you phrase it in your desanctification. If you say, if you have two animals and you say, I want to deconsecrate this animal and place its holiness on this animal, then that's okay. But if you say this animal should substitute for that animal, then that's not okay. It's dachistic.
And if you get this wrong, you get whipped. Okay, I mean, for a difference in framing, this seems a little bit harsh,
Yeah, okay.
Keep hold of the animal, I think that's the moral of the story.
What?
Keep hold of the animal. Pay attention.
So, Kate said, what's this little bit of a shkaga? I'm miskavin lomar... Harezo tmuras ola sheyeshli, v'amar tmuras shlamim sheyeshli. You have a slip of the tongue, and you say, oh, this animal should substitute for the ola that I consecrated yesterday. But you really meant the shlamim, a different type of korban. Nevertheless, harezo tmura veloke. You receive the penalty of lashes. T'mikol moko meizidu betmura. You intended to do a tmura. You just didn't say the type of the exact animal that you really had in mind. But there's another type of shogeg. One shogeg is you just say the wrong thing, you made a mistake. But there's another type of shogeg, which is that you don't even realize that tmura is prohibited. So in such a type of shogeg, then you don't receive the penalty of lashes at all. So here it's impossible for there to be hasra for of warning, because once they warn you, you're going to know that there's the prohibition, and they wouldn't be possible. But independently, the Sefer Chinuch says the reason would be of the shogeg would be enough to exempt you from punishment because you didn't know that it was prohibited. V'im tishal, and if you ask, v'lama lokin al hatmura v'arehu lav shenitak lase. We know that we then generally don't have the penalty of lashes for negative commandments that can be rectified by a positive, by following a positive command. So, whatever, but there's something that can be rectified by a positive commandment, you normally don't receive the penalty of lashes. V'ushim heimir yehehu smuraso kodesh. So what's the positive commandment, which the one we'll discuss next, which of course comes, we're really supposed to have learned before in the order of the Sefer Chinuch. This is the reordering of the Sefer Chinuch. So the positive command is that once you do the tmura, so the tmura is ineffective. It's ineffective, but you receive the penalty of lashes. And both animals are sanctified.
Wow.
It's pay attention.
Yeah.
Hell.
Yeah, so it says in the Chumash explicitly, Vayahu smura so'i yakodesh, both it and the substitute animal, or the attempted substitute animal, should become holy and sanctified as korbanos.
So why would you why would you have two animals in the first place unless you... Why would you have two there so you can say this one?
But you don't have to be both. They don't have to both be together at the same time. You put a, you consecrate an animal as an ola, so you put a little sign on it that says ola, and then you have a different farm in California, and you fly to your farm in California the next day, and you say this is the what?
What do you mean you put a tag on it?
You could.
Yeah.
And a way that doesn't make it a baal mum.
Red strings.
No, not red strings.
So the two don't have to be there when you make that switch.
Red strings are also for humans and animals. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm with you.
Yeah. What do you say?
So the two don't have to be there in order for you to
No. Kvar, so you might think you should get the penalty of lashes because you rectify it. So you... do that, you attempt to do tmura, you violate the mitzvah, then you sanctify the second animal, which is what you're supposed to do. The Gemara says in Maseches Tmura that the reason this is not considered a negative commandment that's rectifiable by the observance of a positive commandment is that there are actually two negative commandments, not a one-to-one. There are two negative commandments and a one positive commandment. So it says, lo yachalifenu v'lo yamiro. So they're not counted as two different commandments, but since it's expressed twice, so the connected positive commandment can only knock off one. But the other one remains, so the lo yachalifenu remains, even if the lo yamiro so is knocked off. So therefore, you get the penalty of lashes, even though... it's nita klase. K'moshe kasavti b'seder z'aseves, v'lo asi aseve v'akar tre lave. So one positive commandment cannot undo two negative commandments. V'od amru tam acher, l'vi she'ein lav de tmura shove la'ase sheba. And there's another reason, which is that it's not an exact rectification of the tamura in the same way that if you take ribis, so it's subject to to pay it back. You could pay back the ribis. So here it's not a one to one. If you steal something, if you steal something, so then you're required to give it back. So it's not that rectifies it. But here the tamura, fulfilling the positive commandment associated with tamura, doesn't rectify your original violation of the negative commandment of tamura.
But you're still bringing it as a korban, though, right?
Right. But it right. So it doesn't undo anything. It's just an additional thing. And also, there's another example that there's not a one-to-one correspondence, which is shat sibor v'chein ha-shutfin ein osin tamura im hemiru. So there are situations where even if you say this animal should substitute for that animal, that you don't violate you're not allowed to do the tamura, but the tamura is ineffective. So in that situation, the positive commandment really is not available for you to rectify the negative commandment. For example, if there are two people that own an animal together, co-ownership, and one of the people says, well, I'm substituting my animal for this animal which I own in a partnership. So that tamura is ineffective. That tamura is ineffective because you're not the sole owner of the original korban. Mm-hmm. So therefore, you violated the commandment, but it doesn't, the animal that you attempted to substitute for the original animal does not absorb the, not absorb, but also become sanctified as the same type of korban that you were attempting, because the original owner is b'shutfus. The ownership is b'shutfus. So therefore, since the positive commandment does not always kick in, so that doesn't help to rectify the negative commandment on a global basis, and therefore is not considered a lav hanita klase.
What just gives him the right to say when you get malchus and when you don't?
God?
It's not explicit in the Torah. What makes the Sefer Chinuch able to determine you get malchus in this case, but not in that case?
Well, this is different to make this up. This is all based in the Gemara, Chazal. Uh-huh. Interpretations of the psukim, sure. Bafapi Shehem Muzharim Shelo Yamiru Mikavan Shein Alav Shavilase Lonemar Vazeshiadino Kalav Shenitak Lase. So since here the positive commandment is not a one to one correspondence, they can always fix the negative commandment, so it's not considered a lav hanitak lase. Vim Tishalo, maybe you ask another question. Vilama Lokin, Ms. Hirsch is saying, no more questions, let's just move on. But the Sefer Chinuch is assuming that she's going to ask more questions. Fim Tish Alod, Vilama Lokin Alavze, why should you receive the penalty of lashes for this commandment? Achar Shev Shalav or Alav, Mi Bli Maise, B'dibor Livad. It's speech. We know in Halacha that speech is not considered an action. So when you violate a mitzvah of the Torah by speech, you don't receive the penalty of Malkos. If you speak Lashon Hara about someone, you do not receive the penalty of Malkos because the Lav Shein B'maisa.
It's interesting that it's not considered an action because it can certainly have heavy-duty effects.
Okay.
Perhaps even more so.
But speech in halacha is not considered an action. Yeah.
I mean, it seems like most of the klalim that have about, you know, like categories of mitzvahs, you know, like, you know, for example, time-bound mitzvahs for women and so on and so forth, that, you know, this is a klal, but there are always exceptions. Is there accepted? There are always exceptions. You know, right? There's no such thing as basically an ironclad rule. You know, most of the, you know.
Ironclad?
I don't know. I mean, something...
No, usually exceptions, yeah.
Okay, so it shouldn't shock us that, you know, that there's...
Right, but we still have to understand why there are exceptions. Okay. When you have exceptions for mitzvah sasei shazman grama, when women are obligated in certain time-bound positive commandments... There are specific reasons for it. So, like, it's always learned out why. So, a woman is chayiv in Kiddush. So the reason is since she's chayef to keep Shabbos, so she's also required to recite Kiddush or hear Kiddush. Korban Pesach explicitly included. Matzah is derived from Korban Pesach. Hakel is explicit in the Torah that women are chayef. Okay.
What is Hakel?
That's when after every Shemitah year, so everybody had to go into the Beis HaMikdash and hear the reading of Sefer Dvarim publicly. Fine. If there's no action, then you don't receive lashes. Chazal say there are a few exceptions, and there are a few negative commandments that are not violated by an action that still are receive the penalty of lashes. Nishba, when you swear falsely. Umeimir, and when you do tmura, umekalel chaveru b'shem, and cursing someone else with the name of God. She'atorech mira b'hem harbe. The Torah wanted to make a point that these are perhaps the most severe things you can do by speech. L'chayv b'malkos afal b'she'in b'hemaisa. There you have to receive lashes even though there's no action. Ve'al teharer d'mishum akimas fasayim hu d'hav y'maisa. Maybe you'll say, maybe moving your lips is considered to be an action. Alav she'in b'maisa, maybe you would think, maybe means that it's something where you literally do no action. It's totally passive. Like, it says, like I said, you know, you're not supposed to ignore a lost object. There's no action whatsoever. If you see a lost object sitting around, you're not allowed to ignore it and go about your business. You have to take it and attempt to return it to the owner.
How do you know whether something is a lost object?
Well, there are rules. We'll get there. But if you there are rules as to what's considered what you should assume to be a lost object and what is not. Not assumed to be a lost object.
You know, like coins are scattered as opposed to stacked up. Bullets are a business, right?
Mm.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's the Gemara, the second paragraph of Metziah. So that's where all the yeshivas start in sixth grade when they start learning Gemara. In an area which is mostly not Jewish, so you assume that all lost objects are non-Jewish lost objects, and you're allowed to keep it. You know, if you find it in the building of YU or something, so then you see all the time that people post on the bulletin boards, you know, lost object, because there you have to assume that it was lost by a Jew, and you have to go through the effort of publicizing that you found this object and seeking out the owner. Whereas for non-Jews, that's not required. Okay. If you have an easy method of identification, like someone asked me a couple weeks ago that he found a wallet with a driver's license in it.
You know who that? Okay.
So I said, absolutely return it. You know, be a kiddush Hashem. You definitely should return.
Jewish, obviously. Also, $5 bill on the sidewalk of Marshall Heights. You could assume that whoever dropped it would be immediate Yiddish, because there's the chance of it staying there for more than 2 minutes is going to be small.
Right. That's also true. There's also a difference between, even if it's a Jewish area, objects that people will be assumed to find out about right away that they lost, and things they might not be sure that they lost, and that they might give up hope getting it back and not give up hope. Yeah, it's complicated. Complicated rules.
I mean, who would?
Jews are family. So things you do for family. So things that you're not required to make yourself crazy for every single person in the world to try to return all their lost objects.
I told you that story about my Christian coworker who found $300 or something like that on the floor out near the bursar's office at Teachers College. Took it to the bursar's office. She's telling her friend about it. The friend says, "Georgia, why didn't you keep it? I'm a Christian. I do stuff like that." And it turned out the person who lost it was very, very distraught and did end up getting it back and was...
Okay, that's an unusual, very unusual case.
Let the record show the person.
It was a private property, though, so that makes more sense. Yeah. You're standing there, somebody was paying.
And it was right near the bursar's office.
It's inside a building.
It just cashed her paycheck.
Okay, it's inside a building.
Are we going to have this nice black Christian lady be better than us about returning stuff? Hello.
We have different criteria for judging better and worse.
Yes,
okay. So don't think that just moving your lips is a ma'isa. Da sikna b'gemara is b'sanhedrin. The gemara in Sanhedrin states, "Dela havya ma'isa," that moving your lips is not considered an action. That's the accepted halachic assumption. Aval vaday below ma'isa klal ikachiu malkos b'ktas averos ve'in shloshan izkaros. But rather, these three sins that we discussed are exceptions to the rule and require malkos even without any action whatsoever. Moving your lips does not count as an action. Umotzi shemra ve'ed zomeim mishum shamalkos miforash b'torah b'hem ki umotzi shemra ve'ed zomeim mihem denafik lan mikra ki go nishba. So those things are explicit in the Torah that if you get married and you accuse your new bride of not being a virgin, then it says in the Torah explicitly, v'yisruoso, that the Bezdin should afflict him, meaning give Malkos, even though that has no Maisa either. So that explicit in the Torah. V'eid zomim is if somebody goes to the Bezdin and testifies that this person is liable for Malkos, but really they were lying. They had hazama that a different group of witnesses comes to the Bezdin and says, hey, the witnesses that testify that this guy is Chaya Malkos can't possibly be telling the truth because they were with us on that day. They claimed to see this guy eating a pork chop. So they were really with us in Ottawa. Whatever. They claimed to saw in New York, but they were with us the whole day, so it's impossible. So the Torah says, that you do to the false witnesses what they testified that should be done to someone else. So they received the penalty of Malkus in this case, because they testified that he ate a pork chop. So that's also a Ein Bo Maisa, but nevertheless, the Torah says explicitly in those two cases that there's a Chiyu Malkus. And so that's the fact that somebody who swears falsely is derived from the Pesukim. So some commentaries explain that you could receive the penalty of Malkus in some situations because an action could result from your words. So since you do tmura, then the second behema that you wanted to switch is also going to become holy, and somebody could violate the prohibition of me'ila. If you derive your own personal benefit from the animal, then you violate me'ila, so that would be a ma'isa. So therefore, it's associated with the ma'isa. But nevertheless, the basic idea is that all these things are just lavshim of ma'isa, but there are specific exceptions for some reason, for various reasons. Shorash ha-mitzvah uksas dineh ha-kokosu b'seder zaseh beiz, which in our order of the Sefer Chinuch is the next mitzvah where he really explains the rules.
There's no case whatsoever where there's any kind of a penalty for thinking something. You know, thinking doesn't exist as a thought crime, right?
You're not supposed to think heretical, idolatrous thoughts, right. But there's no specific penalty, and also thoughts are subject to constant change. So if something pops into your head, you switch your direction of thinking.
Right, okay. And
I need to specify. It's better you shouldn't know. Better you shouldn't know. Okay.
All right. Yeah. You'll know when you see it.
And what if you designated an animal? Did this all to say by email or something like that? Instead of
no, it has to be
list.
Words.
It has to be words. Words in the only
words. There are situations where thoughts actually are effective in halacha. That to be mafresh trumas umaisris, are allowed to do it by thought processes. This is useful, by the way.
Without the physical action of setting something.
Oh no! You have to set it aside. But if you just think, this is truma. Yeah. You usually set it aside first, and then when you do the normal way, which is orally. So you say you set it aside, and you say I raise a truma. The rest is this.
Right, but there's a physical action then. You're setting something aside. And the question is whether or not the intention
No. But the setting something aside doesn't affect the hafreshes truma. What affects the truma is that the declaration that this is now truma. The setting aside is just out of convenience. You know what to throw out give to the kohen or whatever you're doing. So this is actually, this halacha is very convenient on Shabbos. Because for Lecha Mishnah. So I went to someone's house once when I was in yeshiva for a Shabbos meal. So this was someone who was makbid on this on the chumra that I mentioned before, which is not to rely on kashrus agencies for afreshes trumas u'maisrus, but rather to separate the trumas u'maisrus yourself. Always separate trumas u'maisrus yourself. So he had a problem because he wasn't so rich. So all he had was two challahs. So what is he going to do? He can't cut off a piece of the challah. That's not going to be shalim. That's a little bit of a shalim, exactly how much he can cut off and still be shalim. Whatever. Assuming he wanted it to be totally shalim, so he couldn't cut it off to separate the trumas and maisers before. And he can't separate it verbally after making hamotzi before eating the bread, because that's a hefsek between the bracha. So what he did is he hamotzi lechem in aretz. He starts cutting the challah. He sets a little bit aside. He pauses and he thinks for a second. Then he continues, you know, cutting and eating. So that's how fresh is truma sumaisres b'machshava.
Wait a second. Can't you, after eating a piece of it? Oh, I see. Because once you eat, you can't eat it.
Right. Can't eat it unless you're mafresh. Yeah.
Okay.
So there's ordinarily you're not supposed to be mafresh truma sumaisres on Shabbos, but there are ways out of it by either stating your intention before Shabbos that you're going to separate truma sumaisres.
Stating your intention, you might as well do it.
No, because they didn't want to cut the challah.
Oh, sorry. Okay, got it.
But, there are ways out of it, but that's the normal din. Some poskim are mekel, chazanish was mekel, that if you're separating truma sumaisres with something that has a good hashkacha, so since it's extremely unlikely that the thing is really obligated to have truma sumaisres separated, so you're allowed to do it on Shabbos because it's not even considered like a chumra, super chumra, not even real hafresh truma sumaisres. Okay.
Wait, what's the issue of taking
Truma Rashi on Shabbos? It's a concern for, it looks like mitakein. It looks like you're fixing something, mm-hmm. like makeba patish. Mm-hmm. So it's like a lot of rules that you're not allowed to do something that makes something usable on Shabbos because it's...
Like toggling, for example.
Like toggling, yeah, according to some shittas, yeah. According to some shittas, the issue of toggling on Shabbos is only kalim that are actually tummy, but the new... But the toveling that we do nowadays of new dishes is permissible on Shabbos, according to some shittas. But we, especially Ashkenazim, I think Sephardim mostly are also, but especially Ashkenazim, we're machmer that it applies to the immersion of new vessels as well. So as Sephardi, I think some Sephardim are make on this, because the Mechaber in Shulchan Aruch says, so Sephardi, I heard a story once that a Sephardi who apparently used the Erev was toveling his dishes in the Breuer's Kehillah Mikvah on Shabbos. And they were very displeased. They were very displeased with this for several reasons.
Wow. That's pretty amazing.
Uh-huh. Okay, fine. V'noi gizu zeh b'chol makom v'chol zman im avar adam v'higdish behema l'mizbeach v'achach achimira be'edem v'asrach haye malkos. So this applies in all places and all times. Again, do not be makdish anything. You should not sanctify anything to the Beis HaMikdash nowadays. Mm-hmm. But if you did it, and then you said afterwards, I'm replacing my first potential korban with this one, so you'd be liable for violating the Isra of Tamura.
Hold on a second. In other words, if you went ahead and said, I consecrate this sheep for the Beis HaMikdash, but there's no Beis HaMikdash, then it could be anything at all. I mean, what's the problem with it? It's stupid.
Well,
the
Mason Mikdash could be rebuilt in 20 minutes from now. It's sanctified. That's why you have to. You got to get rid of it. That's the problem. That's where your wife's favorite halacha comes into play, where you have to lock the animal in a crate.
All right. So do not. Okay. Right, so the sort of things you don't play around with, like, you know.
You don't play around with it.
Oh, I'm a Knesset, you know, right?
What?
Famous story, you know, kids are saying, I'm a Knesset, you know.
Oh.
Teenagers that came fooling around.
Don't do it. Although there is a way in most situations, so you can redeem. You don't actually have to lock the animal up because you could redeem its kedusha on money.
Then the money basically you put the money in a closet until you destroy the money.
You throw it into the ocean.
Oh.
And use their mikveh to do it because it wasn't their way of doing it. I'm just curious.
I don't know if they threw him out, but
I'm just curious. Would they have the right to impose their own?
I mean, if they really want you using it on Shabbos, they should probably lock it.
I think they have a combination.
There are ways out of it. If you want a tovel like a cup. So on Yontif, or if you use the, I mean, whatever. If you're allowed to carry, you could take the cup. You could take the cup to the Kela Mikvah and you fill it with water, as if you want to drink it. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't think.
And then you accidentally drop it. I mean, I understand.
You fill it up as if you want to drink.
Oh, I see.
You fill the cup up as if you want to drink. Ah, delicious. Oh, actually, this water doesn't look so good. Never mind. And you pour the water back into the Mikvah. That's permissible.
Oh, I see.
There are certain ways where you can get around toveling on Shabbos because it doesn't actually look like you're fixing the object. It sort of could be interpreted also as you just want to drink the water.
Plan ahead.
Yeah, plan ahead. They wouldn't want to lock the Kela Mikvah Yontif because you might have an emergency where you do need to do something like this. Mm-hmm. Of course, if it's a fork, then you have a problem.
What kind of emergency?
Let's say you only have service for 8 people and you realize you invited 12 people for a Yontif meal and you have a new dish that you haven't toveled yet and you need to make sure you have service for all the people you invited. There are other ways to get out of it. To give it as a present to a non-Jew and then borrow it back until you have a chance to tovel it.
Oh my God! And everybody sitting around the table while this is going on.
No.
You realize before. Oh yeah.
If you incur malchus for an action of yours, and who's going to give them to you?
Nowadays, no one. We can't because there's no smicha.
So do they pile up for the day? In other words.
Well, we don't give hasra anymore. You need witnesses. You need a warning.
Uh-huh. Oh.
That was part of the motivation, by the way, that when there was the whole story about the reinstitution of smicha and tzvas in the 16th century, that was right after the expulsion of Spain. You know, there's this whole story about how relying on the Rambam, who has an interesting chiddush, he says that if all the sages of Eretz Yisrael will get together and decide to reinstitute the smicha, you know, the official rabbinic ordination, then that could be a restitution of the smicha. So in Eretz Yisrael, all the rabbis in Tzfas got together and they conferred the real smicha on Mahari Bei Rav, who was the Rebbe of the main Rebbe of Rav Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch. Mm-hmm. There was a whole scandal that the Rav of Yerushalayim, who was, his name was Ibn Habib. So he said, no, it's not valid, because A, the Rambam isn't even so sure. Hey, who says everybody else agrees with the Rambam? And B, the Rambam says you need all the rabbis of Eretz Yisrael to agree with this, and I don't agree. They obviously had arguments against him. Fine. So the Mahari Bei Rav gave the real smicha to a couple of his talmidim, including Rav Yosef Karo, assuming that real smicha was valid. Okay, so who cares? Why do they care about restoring the real smicha? The answer was, you say, you know, how can we get malchus? Because a lot of Jews who were expelled or fled Spain had to... Under duress, they committed sins in Spain, which were a chiyuv of malchus or even a chiyuv of kares. If they had done it,
you can't pay.
Wanted to receive malchus.
They wanted.
Because the rule is that people who are chiyuv of kares, but they receive malchus, so the kares leaves them. The chiyuv kares is not effective. It is destroyed, you know, with the whips of the malchus. So these people felt really bad about the sins they committed in Spain under the duress of living like Christians. So they wanted to receive the malchus. Therefore, there was this pressure to create a bezdin comprised of people with real smicha that had the authority to confer malchus. Okay, so you shouldn't do this. Don't be makdish things.
Don't do this at home.
Very bad. very bad idea. But there, it's interesting that there are certain instances where this halacha is still in play nowadays. That's why Rav Soloveitchik used to tell people when they went to the Kotel that you shouldn't lean on the Kotel. Mm-hmm. Why? Because the stones of the Kotel, we're not sure what they were built from. Maybe they were built from stones that were officially consecrated for use in the Beis HaMikdash. And therefore, if you lean on the stones, then you violate the prohibition of Me'ila.
But the Kotel is just a retaining wall of the hill on which the Beis HaMikdash was
That's
built.
That's true. But even so, if it's donated for the purposes of the Beis HaMikdash, it could have been used for this. So Rav Soloveitchik raised the possibility that there would be a prohibition of Me'ila, of sacrilege, I think is the official English translation, mm-hmm. of using something that's sanctified for your own personal purposes if you lean on the Kotel.
I mean, if you're leaning, wait a second, if you're leaning with your back to it because you're tired, that's one thing, but if you're, you know, like, you know.
It's also, you're using it to support yourself.
All right, whatever.
You're saying you have to go to do tachanun on the Kotel, no.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. The Briskarov wouldn't even get close to the Kotel because he was afraid, he was concerned that there was a mention in certain writings of the Achronim that the Kotel was actually the wall of the Azara and not the wall of the Har HaBayis. So if that's the wall of the Azara, so therefore you couldn't get even close because that you would have to be Tahar in order to go close to the wall of the Azara because you might be considered already on the Har HaBayis precincts. Of course, it's not. It's not. We know that nowadays to 100% certainty that is absolutely false. But nevertheless, he didn't do the research on this, and he saw it in some Achronim. It said this, so okay.
Satmar won't go in Europe because it belongs to the Jordanians, right?
Yeah. Because what?
Oy.
Oh, I don't.
Huh?
No.
Oy,
no. They will not go to the Kotel, right? But the.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, yep. Yeah. Satmars will not. They won't go to the Kotel because they view it as going to the Kotel. Jews taking advantage of the opportunity to going to the Kotel is like giving thanks to the Zionist regime that they reconquered it from the Jordanians in order for the Jews to use. Mm-hmm. So they won't go to the won't go to the Kotel. Yeah, we don't go like that, obviously. But in a Satmar Shchita, so one of the criteria for being a Shochet is that you can never have gone to the Kotel.
Really?
Wow.
You must be kidding.
I'm not kidding.
You can't make this up.
I mean, maybe if you go and do tshuva for having gone, and maybe then that would be okay. But under normal circumstances, a samar shochet, it'll be disqualified as a shochet if you go to the Kotel. You'll also be disqualified if your wife doesn't shave her head, and if you don't wear a strimal, and if you
what?
Don't...
You're kidding.
I'm not kidding.
You can't make this stuff up.
Because they want them to be a very from Samar.
Yeah, they want them to be an upstanding member of the Samar community.
Yeah.
So that's it's a problem. But since they have all these ridiculous non-halachic standards, and regular Orthodox Jews who are just concerned about halacha don't care at all about these things, so that's allowed them to actually take over the market of kosher meats, basically.
Wow.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Most kosher meats nowadays are under Satmar auspices.
Empire
poultry is under Satmar auspices.
Can we find
nowadays?
Somebody else, please? Oh,
yep.
God, Empire.
Because, well, part of it also, who wants to become a shochet? It's not exactly, you know.
Right, so the problem is that other chassidim will eat Satmar shchita, yeshivish people eat Satmar shchita, modern Orthodox people eat Satmar shchita, but Satmar people only eat Satmar shchita. The only people who don't eat Satmar shchita are Lubavitch, and they have their own shchita, okay? So, personally, I'd rather take Samar Shchita than Lubavitch, but the,
Tell us sometime why.
Why? Because, whatever. Whatever. I'll discuss later. But
okay.
It is a problem. We really should, try to, the problem is we're just not that picky. Where if it's halachically kosher, we're willing to eat it. But, so if we would, I would prefer, obviously, if there were a brand of kosher poultry or meat that was not samer, but that was just employed any halachically observant upstanding Jews that showed them. I would prefer to buy that, but there really isn't.
For example.
It's skver.
Isn't that part of Rubashkin?
No, Solomon has nothing to do with Rubashkin. No? Solomon is skver. It's not Samar. Yeah, okay. But the same, similar idea. They might allow the Shochtim to go to the Kotel, but they definitely do require the Shochtim to have their wives shave their head, and they can't trim their beards and all these things. Yeah.
I mean, wait, is
there a possibility of excommunication?
We can do that without the official smicha. That you
don't need a
special
smicha. Satmar does it all the time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Well, so wait a second. It sounds to me like some sort of a, you know, like union rules to sort of, you know, keep like the wrong people out of the business or something like that.
No.
You know, right? I mean, it's...
Yeah. What do you mean? But it doesn't have to do with the employment of the shochtim per se. It just has to do with business realities, which is that everyone will eat Samar Shchita, but they want theirs. They want their standards.
And there are a lot of them.
There are a lot of them, but it makes sense. Like, Empire Poultry is... The company is not a Samar company. The Hechsherim on Empire Poultry are OU and KJ, which are not at all... Not Chassidish. Mm-hmm. Even, but in Maisa, all the Shochtim, they're Chassidish, because they also, the factory of Empire...
Satmar won't eat Empire, will they?
Those who know, those who are in the know will eat nowadays, because they realize, they know what's going on. But the truth is, the thing is, Empire wanted to hire a regular Black Hat Lakewood Shochet,
mm-hmm.
So the Hechsherim wouldn't have any problem with that. Yeah. But the problem is that Empire also produces poultry for certain other Chassidish brands.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
So it's more efficient for them just to hire Chassidish Shochtim.
Right.
So that way everyone will give
if Empire found out that the Shochet had gone to the Kotel,
Kosher Poultry would not fire him.
But the
Chassidish Rav Amashir. So for example,
would stop using.
For example, Meal Mart Ali Poultry is currently shechted at the Empire factory.
Oh.
So the head of Rav Amashir of that is the Nir Batra Rav, who's affiliated with Samar. So he wouldn't allow...
this assembly line.
If he found out that one of the shochtim went to the Kotel, so he would get rid of that shochet. And then it wouldn't make sense for Empire Poultry to, you know, when the shchita that's going to be packed in the OUKAJ label, so then he's allowed to shecht. But if it's going to be packed under the Ali Milmar label, then he's not allowed to shecht. So it doesn't make sense. So they just keep all Samar shochtim.
This sounds like a combination of restraint of trade. You know,
it's business realities. They are allowed to set their own rules. People, get over it.
Yeah, they are, but
there's enough other Jews that actually wanted to be on the shochtim. They might be, but they don't.
Nobody else wants to do it.
Wants to be a
shochet.
There are some. But there is no commercial poultry shchita in America. That is not Chassidish. Either Satmar or Satmar-like, Chassidison or Lubavitch.
Right.
All the commercial, 100%.
But like, say, beef and
beef is mostly also Chassidish, but there's a little more variety. Not an insignificant amount of meat that comes from the Starkey's plant in Baltimore, and there they have a non-Chassidish shochet. That's what the information that they told me. Mm-hmm. Okay, so but that's not in New York. We don't have that. We don't have that so much in New York. We have mostly, mm-hmm. you know, Meal Mart, Solomon's, things like that, which are.
Would they buy one of your mezuzahs?
Would who?
The Satmar, you use your mezuzahs?
No, for sure not. No, they also want. They also want their own people as Sofrim. They want 100%. I work a lot of times with a Safras store in Williamsburg, and very, very, very nice people themselves. But they, I hear a friend of mine also goes there, that people come in all the time. He's there more than I am. So you have someone comes in the street, so he starts asking question. You know, this is a nice Megillah. You know, the sofer, this is wife wear a sheitel, and they want to hear it. Of course, that she doesn't wear a sheitel; she wears a. You know, a cloth covering or a sheitel on top. Not that, as opposed to not covering her hair. If he lives in Eretz Yisrael or America? In Eretz Yisrael, does he vote in elections? All these ridiculous things that have nothing to do with halacha, but they want their ritual things to come from people that share their heimishness. Uh-huh. You know, their it's a big problem. It's a big problem. It's a big problem because the market dictates it. Because we care about halacha, so we don't mind if our sofer is a sadmer, as long as he's a Yerusha Mayim.
There would be limits, though. It's not just a mechanical process.
What do you mean?
I mean, there would be a point at which you would say, wait, I don't want that person to be writing my...
Oh, absolutely.
You have to be thinking the right thoughts.
If I were giving a hetzer to a slaughterhouse... Would I take a shochet who dresses in, he goes around town dressed in t-shirt and shorts, even if he's completely Shomer Shabbos? Probably not. Because you want a shochet to be,
serious.
To be a serious,
A gray suit or something.
If a person who's full, but there's a difference between whom you appoint as an official shochet and eating the shechita. If there's somebody who wears t-shirt and shorts and he was fully Shomer Shabbos and fully from, and he happened to shech the chicken, so I would eat it. It's not a matter of not eating it, but it's also a matter of whom you appoint as, you know, the representatives of your community to officially engage in the in the trade of shechita, which is why the chassidim are so makpid on who the shochet is as opposed to the halachic criteria.
In terms of, like, if you write a sefer Torah,
mm-hmm.
there are all sorts of requirements, I thought. You have to have, I don't know, done Nagelwasser and not be thinking correct thoughts when you write the name of the Mikvah and stuff like that, isn't that?
I mean, that's those not halachic requirements.
Down. Oh, it isn't?
No. Even
just sit down as long as it's correct and it's made with a pen on the right.
And you have to have intention that you're writing a Sefer Torah. Yeah. When you come to the name of God, you need to have intention that you're writing the name of God. Yeah, but
suppose you have somebody who's...
There are rules, but I'm saying you could have someone sit and write a Sefer Torah, who again, like a Yusak. Use the same example. You could have someone who doesn't dress in what we would consider to be a mechubadik manner. I'm not saying who goes to the gym like this. I'm saying somebody who walks around in the Mea Shearim. If he's Shomer Shabbos and a firm person, so then the Sefer Torah is 100% kosher. But you still wouldn't, I still wouldn't appoint this person as an official sofer and, sell. Yeah, there's a difference between whom you appoint and what's kosher with the evidence.
I was going to give an extreme example.
Yeah.
It's not so extreme. Suppose you have someone who's like sort of your old-fashioned, serious, conservative
person,
from like the 50s or something. People who kept Shabbos and stuff, but their ideology might not be 100% like Orthodox or whatever.
What do you mean,
if they went to a shul, with mixed seating
with mixed seating.
At that point, you get
they had dancing.
Mm-hmm. No.
Look, even if...
But if the person was a technically qualified sofer, would you... This is information purposes only. There's a tone of voice here. Would you consider that, even though the person is, according to his lights, from...
It depends how bad his deus were. I mean, if somebody had completely, believed in God and the Torah and everything, and kept Shabbos 100%, but just misguidedly worshipped in a synagogue with mixed seating.
Uh-huh. So rabbis in fact until fairly recently, in fact,
right, so that technically, would certainly not disqualify a person absolutely on to passel their shechita or something like that.
Or their sefer Torah. Would you want? This is again.
Would I hire this person as a shochet or a sofer and sell their meat or their writing in a store I was running? No, but if I would, for some reason go to their house and they had served meat that they shechted, I don't see the problem with eating that.
You would use their sefer Torah.
If that's what was available. I would use it.
Again, no tone of voice, just curious.
To technically pass a l'shchita, you need to either be Michal Shabbos, so you need to be, not believe in God and the Torah. I mean, it's major things. Even if you occasionally indulge in a pork chop, it doesn't you just have to have it, mouth-watering. It doesn't pass your l'shchita, technically. Again, we would never in a million years take someone like that to be shochet nowadays, an official shochet, but... To technically halachically pass the shechita, it takes a decent amount to actually do that. If you eat non kosher meat on purpose, if you have you go to the store and you have non kosher and kosher meat, and you go ahead and you buy the non kosher meat, then that does pass the shechita. Yeah. It's not.
Well, I mean, it seems like that's professionally that they didn't. Obviously, you don't care about kosher meat.
Exactly.
Puzzle you from how. Mm-hmm.
So if anyone here wants to go into business and you want to open a Misnagda Shechita slaughterhouse, I'd be perfectly happy for you to do that. But until then, until then, it's not. We have to deal with what we have on the market, which
and
again is mostly
Chassidish.
Oh no, not at all.
Okay.
In Israel, no. In Israel, it's interesting that in general, non-Hasidim are much more powerful in Israel than they are in America. In America, Hasidim generally control the religious services. In Israel, not at all. You know, it's sort of like in America, it's sort of viewed as like, just to give it a Hasidish, non-Hasidish example, it's sort of viewed as like really, really from people, you know, prefer to eat hand matzah. Whereas in Israel, because that's not the case at all, that there are people, you know, they're really chashuv major Haredi Hasherim that give a hechsher on machine matzah because not a lot of non-Hasidim actually prefer machine matzah and they... So the Badatz of the Eid HaRedis, you know, gives a hechsher on machine matzah. Eid HaRedis is not a Hasidish organization.
Yeah.
The Eid HaRedis has Hasidim and non-Hasidim, briskers, followers of the Vilna Gaon, Yerushalmim, a lot of people, different people in the Eid HaRedis. But you have also, you know, like the regular yeshivish non-Hasidish community is much more powerful in terms of kashrus and religious things than they are in Israel. They have their own hashgacha.
Also Sephardim. Yeah.
Sephardim also much more powerful in terms of their own organizations than they are.
Sephardish Shechita, whatever they call it.
Never heard of such a thing.
Yosef Glot.
Oh, that's in terms of checking the lungs, but that's nothing to do with who the shochet is.
Okay, right. So
they do. As far as
so
I'm aware...
They're not like Tatmar. They're not like... They don't know if they're the exclusionary,
No, they're not. But it's actually funny. I heard a story in America, obviously, but there's a cute story that I heard that... this is in America, again, where the Chassidim are in charge. So a Sephardi Shochet came to one of the Chassidish slaughterhouses and applied for a job. So they said, oh, we can't hire you. This is a Chassidish Shechita. So the Sephardi said, well, what do I have to do in order to get hired? So they told him, you have to start wearing a shtreimel on Shabbos. So he started wearing a shtreimel on Shabbos, and they hired him.
He learned Yiddish, too.
That's the state of affairs. This one, it says in a store or a hashgacha that they use only chassidish shechita as complete nonsense according to halacha. There's no... What it just come to mean... in general parlance, as it means that it's a shkita that's under chassidish auspices. It started because in America...
Wait, what was the knives controversy back there, Bill, 300 years ago?
Now everybody uses the same type of knives. There's no difference in the knives. But the way it started is when in America, and around the time of World War II, when you had the influx of the Hungarian chassidish communities... So they weren't happy with the state of affairs of the American shchitos that were in the state at the time, which were perceived to be lax. So they labeled their own shchitas as chassidish shchita.
Right.
And people thought, oh, it's more reliable because they care more about halacha. And so people used to think that chassidish shchita was like a maila, you know, like a chumrah in the meat, chassidish shchita. So nowadays, when it says chassidish shchita, it just means under chassidish auspices. But nowadays, in terms of halacha, all the hechsherim, all the good hechsherim, have exactly the same standards, and again, there is no such thing nowadays as an OU shchita. That's a misnagdish shchita. That's not chassidish, but there be no difference whatsoever in halacha between a shchita that was under the auspices of the OU and one that's under the auspices of Samar. So it's really just still a marketing gimmick that people use that they say, oh, we use only chassidish shchitas if it sounds
so, you know, everybody
sounds more from.
Basically, so
but even Empire nowadays is chassidish shchita, which is 30 years ago. It wasn't. They had all types of shochtim there 30 years ago.
So
but it's,
if the okay, to get back to the okay,
yeah.
The okay is Lubavitch. They presumably use...
There's no okay meat, as far as I know.
It's
just not available.
Even though they're the biggest cautious organization in the world,
I believe there's no or very little okay meat. On some cold cuts that come from Israel, I've seen an okay, but... Like as an extra hashgacha, but I don't believe they're under. Even the Lubavitch
shechita is not okay.
The Lubavitch shechita, unfortunately, is under. Also has OU on it.
Oh.
Yeah. What's the Lubavitch shechita? There's David Elliott chicken, the CHK Crown Heights Kashrus shechita. You have Shor Habar, which is produced by Rabashkin, which is CHK.
Wait, not Rabashkin. Rabashkin himself is out of the business, though.
Right, but the company formerly known as Rabashkin's.
But that's owned by the Canadian guy, though, I thought, right?
Yeah, it's owned by the Canadian guy. He's not Lubavitch, but... Okay, but they still have a line in that slaughterhouse that's That's a CHK Shkita. There are certain meats that have Karan Heis Kashrus on them, but they also have an OU, because the OU holds, even though I know Karan Heis Kashrus themselves would not be Makbid on this, but the OU says they're Makbid, that they will not take a Lubavitcher Shochet who's openly Mashiachist declares that the Rebbe is Mashiach. Again, believing that the Rebbe is Mashiach per se would not pass a Lashchita, technically. Again, we non-Lubavitcher people would not want someone like that to serve as an official Shochet. But the problem is, as Rabbi Dr. David Berger points out in his book, the problem is that basically Lubavitchers who are really don't believe the Rebbe's Mashiach are very few. The ones that are called non-Mashiachists, which mean that they don't go, you know, parading the fact that they believe the Rebbe's Mashiach. Then they're the ones that go parading the Rebbe's Mashiach, but he's concerned, based on certain of his studies, that if they parade the Rebbe's Mashiach, really it's even worse, and they believe that the Rebbe was a deity.
Oh dear God!
Which is, and there are some that openly declare that. There's some that openly declare that the Rebbe was.
That's right. You said.
There's some that openly declare that the Rebbe was a deity.
Insane. Mm-hmm.
Read David Berger.
Even though it has a CHK, since it has no U, also we hope that their makbid, that at least openly mashiachist who might be of the Avodah Zarah, will not be allowed to show.
No, I worked with Lubavitchers who said, look, the real controversy inside Lubavitch is how public do you make the belief that the Rebbe's Mashiach after he's dead?
Right. So since some...
I'll ask you later about a mutual friend.
So we hope they're on top of it, but...